секретарь Совета Безопасности России, бывший глава ФСБ.
Николай Патрушев, московский комсомольец, о котором мы сейчас...
Патрушев рассказал о заинтересованности США.
The international community should thank Russia for forcefully seizing Crimea. The United States seeks the dismemberment of Russia so it can take over its natural resources, and European leaders take their orders from Washington. These are just a few of the comments Security Council Secretary Nikolai Patrushev made this week in an interview with the mass circulation tabloid Moskovsky Komsomolets. And Patrushev, it is worth noting, is one of Vladimir Putin's closest confidants. It's tempting to dismiss the nuttier statements of Kremlin officials as disingenuous and largely designed for domestic consumption. But a recent report by veteran Kremlin watcher James Sheriff of Chatham House suggests that top Russian officials actually believe much of their own hype. In this worldview appears to be driving policy. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me from Oxford, England, is veteran Kremlin watcher James Scher, an associate fellow at Chatham House, Chatham House's Russia and Eurasia program, and author of the recently published report, The New East-West Discord, Russian Objectives and Western Interests, which we will be discussing today. Welcome back to the podcast, James, and thanks for the thought-provoking reports.
Thank you.
And also joining us from Moscow is foreign affairs analyst Vladimir Frolov, president of the Left Group and a columnist for Sloan.ru. Welcome back, Vladimir.
Thanks, Brian. Good to be back.
Good to have you back. So the United States is irreconcilably hostile to Russia, and the threat is systemic. Europe is decaying and divisive and lacks the cohesion and the mettle to pay the price for that its principles dictate. The West is in decline and has lost its monopoly on the globalization process. And the true independence of the former Soviet states and Russia's periphery is a national security threat. And Russia is entitled to a privileged sphere of influence based on so-called Yalta principles. James, this is the psychological prism you outlined that structures the Putin regime's approach to the world. It's the product of indignation that's been rising since the 1990s. And the recovery of national power that's been happening since Putin came to power. And it's personified by Putin, who is as much a product of the KGB as what you call the Darwinian conditions of the 1990s in Russia. So let's to get the ball rolling, James, is this the world? If this is the world, according to Moscow, there's little hope for anything but conflict. Do you really believe this is how the Kremlin views the world? And is this fixed and chronic, or is it malleable?
Well, the Kremlin is capable of exaggerating to different audiences, and of course they lie. But these perceptions are really there. Some of them, of course, predate Vladimir Putin. Even in the Soviet Union, Russia had what the Soviets had, what I call an only child syndrome. Lilia Shevtsova later even wrote a book about this, by which I mean they are not only imbued with their own importance, but they see a lot of actions that they don't like in the world as being directed against them, even when they're motivated by other factors. The most salient ones being NATO and EU enlargement, the Kosovo conflict, and one can multiply these examples. So since they see U.S. hegemony as directed against them, then by definition, it's a threat, and they are determined to use all means available to counter it. Add to that, Brian, two other factors. First, there has been a real retrenchment of the elite since Putin returned de jure to the presidency in 2012. Initially, there was this was a relatively inclusive system. Of course, the Siluviki, the security and military people were very strong, but there were also the economic liberals. There was the old Moscow establishment of Yeltsin. After 2012, these people have been marginalized and excluded. And so basically you have a very narrow circle now with very similar training, background, assumptions, talking to one another. And so the distorting filters are much thicker than they used to be. And the final point, if I may, this is understood, I think, correctly, to be a conflict not only about interests, but also about what we call values. There's no paranoia in understanding that the enlargement of the EU's rules-based and rights-based model in Europe has implications internally for Russia's own system of governance. So EU enlargement policy, the attractiveness, still partial attractiveness of the EU, is seen as a threat, and it's perfectly rational for them to try to use all measures to counter it, not just at home, but proactively inside the EU itself. So that's where we are, and this makes for this doesn't necessarily lead to violent conflict, but as long as this view of the world is in place, systemic conflict exists, and it's going to continue.
And is that view of the world malleable?
I think you would need different people in place to make it malleable.
So with this regime
in power, this view of the world coincides with what they call pragmatism. They understand if you're facing a very strong opponent who's confident of his own strength and knows how to use it, you have to retreat. You have to figure out a way of doing that. This is perfectly reconcilable with practical calculations, but some new ingredient would have to enter the equation. A major ingredient would have to enter the equation in order for this view of the world to be abandoned or even properly questioned.
Vladimir, would you agree with James's outline of the Kremlin's worldview and of its implications?
Let me just begin by congratulating James on an excellent report, and I read it with immense interest. I think I would pretty much agree with this, but I would probably add some nuance to this line. I think the vision that James describes is and has been malleable, and it has been different in different periods. And of course, the tendency to view the post-Soviet space as an area of Russia's privileged interests and Russia's dominance is a canon of Russian foreign policy in the post-Soviet era. And even pro-Western liberals like Anatoly Chubais called for liberal empire in 2003, and President Medvedev, who was one of the initiators of the reset, introduced the term privileged interest in 2008 after the war with Georgia. But again, it should be noted that before 2012, 2013, that was a pretty much non-confrontational view. I mean, it was a view to express displeasure, to express annoyance and irritation at being ignored, but not to engage in outright confrontation with the West. And in fact, one of the canons of the Russian post-Soviet Russian foreign policy has been to avoid a confrontation, a forceful confrontation with the West at all possible means. And only in 2014, the Russians essentially crossed that line when they decided that avoiding a confrontation with the West was no longer necessary. And they had to, and they decided that they could afford to act and confront the West
because they felt so threatened by the example that a westernized Ukraine would present, or because they thought they could do it. They'd gotten powerful enough that they could do it.
Well, I think both are in play. Both are in play.
Yeah,
James.
I think if I just interject. I think what Vladimir said is quite consistent with my view that the world view hasn't changed. What did change at the end of 2013 was the abrupt change from a situation where they felt they finally had Ukraine's president Yanukovych exactly where they wanted him, and then only to discover he has been overthrown, and suddenly Russia has no influence in Ukraine at all. And given their view of what was at stake there and in Europe as a whole, they naturally changed the game. Mm. And Putin is someone who has demonstrated again and again a willingness and ability to change the game whenever he gets into a corner. So, you know, this was the biggest game change. Mm.
I think what is new in Russian foreign policy after 2014 is the willingness to take very radical, even, you know, riskier action to achieve certain political objectives.
Now, this action has had some costs. If you look at the Russian economy right now, look at the ruble. You don't have to look far to see that this is incurring costs economically. James, this is something we've kind of we're going back and forth on off mic over the course of the week. Do you think external factors such as the current economic crisis could cause this cognitive prism to shift and lead Moscow to sue for peace, so to speak?
I don't see that happening. The Kremlin, of course, is aware of the magnitude and severity of these economic pressures as anybody else. It doesn't mean that they are going to adopt the Western economists' schema of rationality and, as you say, sue for peace. And I don't see much sign of that happening. They're adjusting their scheme of maneuver. There's no denying that. And that's as much designed to unbalance and divide their opponents as it is to do anything else. And they're clearly willing to contemplate further retrenchment when they have to. And as Vladimir said a moment ago, now when they're under pressure and before when they were not under pressure, this is a high risk-taking leadership. So I have yet to see any sign of a qualitative change, and I'm not expecting that we're going to see it soon.
Now, we're going to talk more about Ukraine in the second segment, but do you, just by way of example, do you see a lot of observers are interpreting the diplomatic maneuvers surrounding Donbass as an attempt to basically cash out of that casino while it's still possible, get sanctions lifted, and maybe save the economy? Wouldn't that be? Do you see this as just a tactical maneuver or a shift?
Well, the evidence people cite for a real shift doesn't add up. The new people they have appointed to oversee the process in Donbass are are people whose only consistent feature is absolute competent promotion of Kremlin objectives, whatever they have to be.
And we're speaking of Dmitry Kozak.
I think if we're talking about Donbass, I think the new feature is that now that they've got Syria and Daesh to fight with the West, I think they have what they figured out is that now is the time that they can force the West to force the Ukrainians to implement the Minsk the way Russia wants it to be implemented. Mm. So I don't see it.
No, I agree.
I think they're delusional about that.
I suspect Vladimir agrees with me, but I think from where the Kremlin sits, the West is as weak politically as they are economically. And the Syrian operation is, as they understand it, a strategic diversion. Mm. It's designed to persuade a West that's already Western Europe's already suffering from Ukraine fatigue, that it's really time to make some serious compromises with Russia's point of view, and offer some symbolic progress, which is not going to address the core issues in Ukraine.
I would say that politically, the Kremlin can no longer afford to look as if it were suing for peace. Mm-hmm. I mean, It has made the foreign policy success, the bolstering of Russia's role as a super, as a global power, as a world power, an integral part of its domestic support, as a source of its domestic legitimacy. So that It can basically cannot afford a situation in which it suffers a foreign policy loss. And suing for peace would be a foreign policy loss. So they want to lift sanctions, to get sanctions lifted, but not at the cost of appearing for having to ask for it.
Right. Now, Vladimir, sticking with you, going back to the original question I posed to James, and I think I know how you're going to answer this because I read you regularly and I've heard you speak on this. But do you what would you say about the extent to which external factors like the economy can cause a shift, if not in the cognitive prism, at least in behavior?
Well, it probably might limit some of the means available to conduct a risky and challenging foreign policy. But it doesn't particularly change the calculus and the objectives. It can cause a delay in implementation of the objectives, or a change of tactics doesn't change the objectives. Right now the Kremlin is much more dependent on foreign policy success than on economic success. Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, because we've kind of been here before in the 70s when high oil prices coincided with a very assertive Soviet foreign policy. And then when we hit the period of low oil prices and economic crisis, we had perestroika. You don't see that kind of a history repeating itself in
perestroika was made possible by a change of leadership.
Okay. So again, you would agree with James that only under a change of leadership are we going to see a change in policy and behavior?
Well, that's probably would be a fair assessment.
How likely do you think that is?
In my view, not very likely in the near future.
Not very likely in the near future. Now, I paid a lot of attention to Lavrov's press conference this week, and he called for a reset. It was a strange kind of a reset, which basically Moscow gives nothing, changes nothing, a reset with no costs. A reset where the rest of the world would essentially pretend that the last 2 years never happened. Is this in the cards, James? What do you think?
I think it's less unrealistic in 2016 than it was in 2015. Mm. There is fatigue in some parts of the West. There are some major players in Europe who want to abandon sanctions. There is this enormous appetite for getting back to business as usual in certain quarters. And then you have this constant refrain that if we're going to have very long-term tensions with Russia, Ukraine is just not worth it. So many people buy the Russian argument that it's a basket case and it's not worth it. So I think it's going to be more difficult this year for us to maintain the remarkable unity we have displayed so far. But Russia is still going to have a very, very tough time selling this. And I think it's in the balance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what we're also missing from this debate is what is the Russian offer of the positive side? What is the positive agenda that it offers for the reset? Only Syria and the fight against Daesh, and then what?
And
what are the Russian terms for the reset?
And what are they doing there? I mean, I don't know what
about what they say they're doing.
What either of you thought of the FT report that said that they tried to ease Assad out, and he said no. If that's the case, they can't deliver the one and only thing the West wants from them, and that's an orderly exit for Assad. So what are they really bringing to the table in Syria? I'm not even sure.
The West reacts very strongly to such indications because we're always thinking in terms of personalities. When the Russians are concerned, the Russians are determined to preserve the system, the political system and the control system that Assad created. And when they say we're not wedded to Assad, they mean, you know, he could be moved aside and there could be a cosmetic change that leaves everything else
right.
Intact. Their policy in Syria has been quite consistent and very much at variance from what they say it is. They are doing very little to attack Daesh because Daesh is not the main opponent to preserving that part of Syria they want to preserve, which is, you know, the Alawite areas on the coast. So I don't really see many signs that this is changing. And in fact, even in France, which is originally very enthusiastic about having a grand coalition after these horrendous attacks in Paris, they're looking at the targeting data as much as anybody else, and they're not fooled by what the Russians are doing. Mm. And to add into the mix, I would say the Russians are more than happy to add to our refugee problems. You can only simply look at the Northern Europe, where they have been directing more refugees into Finland and Norway. They've gone up; the number has gone up about 1,000% in the past year.
Vladimir,
No, I would agree that the objective is to keep the regime, the Syrian regime, intact, either with acid or without acid. That would be a secondary consideration. But the most of the elements of the regime, particularly the security forces, the armed forces, the army, that's the major objective, to keep it intact. That's why, for example, Moscow essentially ditched the Geneva communique, which mm-hmm. called for transitional governing body, which actually called for the transfer of power, and now sticks with the Vienna statement, which only calls for the national unity government, which is a modification of the Assad regime. Mm-hmm. So I think that objective remains, whether it's achievable with Assad or whether it's achievable without him. That's a secondary consideration.
No, this brings me back, Vladimir, to this point you raise. What positive agenda would Russia be bringing to any hypothetical reset?
I think right now the sell, and probably that's the sell to Kerry right now, is that, well, even if Assad stays and participates in the elections, we need Assad for the transitionary period in which we could get the Syrian army after we deal with the opposition, either through truces or through demolition of the opposition. Then we need Assad to go for the land operation, ground operation against Daesh. Mm. I think that's the selling point.
But beyond Syria, is there anything? I mean, why would the West be so eager for business as usual? Is it just business?
Well, I think apart from Syria, they're selling the same message on Libya and Afghanistan, fighting Daesh in Libya and Afghanistan. And, you know, Lavrov is on record saying that we need to restore the statehood in Libya and Afghanistan, which essentially indicates some operations.
James, what do you think here?
Russia is, you know, whether there's, even if it is not practical in economic terms to create the mobilization system that is talked about in Russia, psychologically they're in a state of mobilization, and the elite and the populations there are used to it. The West is not used to this. And so when we talk about a long-term problem, long-term tensions with Russia, the political class and the ordinary citizen in the West thinks in terms of something going on for months and possibly a couple of years and no longer. And, you know, once you get outside the realm of experts and military people who really deal with this, you don't find that many people in the West who are willing to accept that on top of this monumental struggle we have with Daesh and all kinds of uncertainties about China, we now must be mobilized indefinitely against Russia as well. So, you know, these are real political and psychological factors that inhibit an effective Western response and inhibit long-term strategic patience.
Mm. So this goes back to that the Russia sees the West as politically weak as the West sees Russia as economically weak. Now, the past couple of weeks, we've had the Litvinenko report coming out of the UK. We've had a U.S. Treasury official on camera for the BBC, sitting U.S. Treasury official on camera for the BBC, saying that Putin is corrupt. And this got me thinking, I mean, is the mask is sort of coming off for the West, right? I mean, there's not even this pretense of pretending this regime is respectable anymore. Does that have any meaning?
I don't think this is a revelation for people here. And the issue is not that Putin is corrupt, but that he is the fulcrum of an essentially predatory neo-feudal type of system, which is based on a complete merger between money and power. And you know, it's the system that's the real issue. And he has so far been better from the system's perspective at managing it and maintaining authority than anyone else you can name. And that's another factor that strengthens the sort of the logic of stability inside this elite world.
Mm. Vladimir, would you agree with that?
I think the recent statements, particularly from the United States, the Treasury official, and what we had yesterday, the White House spokesman, essentially saying the White House stands by this assessment. I mean, all of this is producing systemic shocks in Moscow, and you have Presidential Press Secretary Peskov going on the record today, saying this is part of the U.S. plot to influence the Russian presidential campaign of 2018, and to make Vladimir Putin not to run for re-election, irrespective of whether he has plans to do so or not. So it's really of concern here, and it's producing some reaction.
Why do you think that's the case? That's interesting.
Well, that's in my view, it's an overjudgment by the Kremlin. They should have taken a much calmer line and dismissed it. But the fact that Peskov went on the record today is very significant. Mm. I think they're overblowing the problem.
Yeah, and they're. Go ahead, James.
No, I'm just saying that, you know, despite everything we've said, I think there's an undercurrent of nervousness and apprehension amongst these people and in a system of this kind. Because despite these poll ratings, it is very difficult to know what people really think or why they think what they do. And whilst the average Russian understands perfectly well how corrupt daily life is, it doesn't necessarily see all of this as coming from the top. And that is probably, you know, this is the element that I think accounts for Peskov and the Kremlin reacting the way they have.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to hit on one more thing before we move on to the second segment and talk about Ukraine.
Yeah.
And that's the consequences of being wrong. Now, I mean, James, you painted out a series of elements in the Russian worldview. One is a hostile U.S., which I would argue is completely inaccurate. But being wrong on this has created a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's created a more hostile U.S., if you will. You had Obama, the initiator of the reset, now becoming public enemy number one in Russia and being harder line on Russia than I ever expected him to. Being wrong about Europe, that it's weak and divided and doesn't have the mettle to support its values, this has led to the loss of Germany as Russia's strategic partner in Europe. Being wrong about the favorable global conditions, you said that the world was moving away from the West and it was moving to other actors such as the BRICS countries and China. This has led to an isolated Russia. And they were wrong about their neighborhood, the former Soviet space, which potentially could lead to the loss of Ukraine. Are there consequences to this worldview being wrong?
James. There might be eventually. There might be eventually. But, and you know, I mean, just to add to the list, it would be inconceivable to see NATO once again investing in becoming a serious military instrument in Europe had all these things not happened. So, as you say, their way of thinking and their actions have realized a lot of their own prophecies. But you can still look at all the facts if you're sitting there and come to more optimistic conclusions. I mean, after all, first of all, Merkel's position in Germany is no longer unassailable. The socialists in Germany If they should come back to power, we will see a real difference in policy. They do wish to mend fences with Russia. They're driving the Nord Stream 2 project in defiance of the European Commission. If you look at Hollande, both of his political opponents are pro-Putin. There are all sorts of factors you can find to make a different kind of case. And add just one other thing, too, that in this Kremlin mindset, what really matters most is how much you damage the other guy, which is why I've said I think they're masters of creating lose-lose outcomes. Whatever they might or might not gain from it, Russia, by damaging Ukraine, by gutting its center of industry, they feel they're doing something. They feel they're doing something positive. That's not our way of looking at things. But of course, we're not talking about us.
Mm-hmm. No, it all goes back to that old Russian proverb of you, the genie tells a guy he'll give him one thing, but he'll give his neighbor twice what he gives him. And the guy says, poke my eye out. Is this along those lines, James?
I don't think it's consciously. I don't think that it's a conscious motivation in that way. Mm-hmm. But it tends to be the operational code regardless.
Mm-hmm. Vladimir, would you agree or what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think that the Russians see some benefits from this. They don't necessarily view this analysis as wrong. I think the benefit that they perceive in accruing is that by being confrontational and creating a conflict with the West, they force the West to deal with Russia as an important factor, as an important power, and to deal with Russia on Russia's terms. I think the whole point is not to be is not to wage war on the West. The whole point is to make the West talk to Russia in the way Russia wants the West to talk to it. That's the point of the Syrian operation. Mm-hmm. And I think they've had some success. They've had some. Minsk too is a testament to that strategy.
Mm. Absolutely. There's an old refrain, which has been revived now under Putin, which is that no problem in anywhere can be resolved without taking the Russian view into account. And the major objective is to make everyone understand that whatever you wish to accomplish, you will need Russia in order to accomplish it. Mm. And in this, they have a right to think they're being successful.
Mm. On that note, we'll shift gears. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and take a look at the state of play in Ukraine and what James calls Moscow's hard diplomacy and soft coercion in Russia's neighborhood. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name's Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Scott, Oxford, England, is veteran Kremlin watcher James Scher, an associate fellow with Chatham House's Russia in Eurasia program, and author of the recently published report, The New East-West Discord, Russian Objectives and Western Interests. Also joining us from Moscow is foreign affairs analyst Vladimir Frolov, president of the Left Group and a columnist for Sloan.ru. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Россия не ведет никаких переговоров о
возвращении ее вмешательства в военный конфликт на востоке
Украины.
Минске
тем временем готовится к новой встрече трехсторонней контактной группы по Украине.
Нулевую динамику урегулирования конфликта.
Russia has little historical experience living with neighbors who are friendly and independent. You wrote that, James, and I find it hard to disagree. And so would the Ukrainians or the Georgians, for that matter. One of the things I really appreciated in this report was the comprehensive treatment you gave to the causes, consequences, and state of play in the Ukraine conflict. So let's talk about that for a bit here. What is the state of play in Ukraine? There seems to be some momentum to solve the Donbas conflict. On whose terms, James? And where do you see that heading?
Well, I think there are three elements now. I remember in the end of 2014, one of the Kremlin insiders said to me, don't worry, James, Ukraine will not exist in a year's time. Mm-hmm. Well, Ukraine very much exists. But still, from their perspective, if you look at the state of the Ukrainian economy, you look at what we're obliged to call very mixed record of dealing with underlying problems in Ukraine. You look at the stress of war. You look at what has happened to Donbass. They could still preserve optimism that this country is not going to hold itself together forever. So, you know, this is the first element. The second we've touched on already, which is growing Ukraine fatigue in the West. Moscow could see very clearly that when Biden comes to Kiev, he gives President Poroshenko an absolute pasting for not really not addressing the heart of the problem and fighting corruption in a systemic way. And thirdly, you know, we have now, for the reasons we've described, all these tactical maneuvers, and suddenly we have this very closed, enigmatic process of discussions taking place between Victoria Nuland and Vladislav Surkov in Kaliningrad about Donbass, and it's causing a lot of anxieties as to whether the West, which already traded some fundamental interests in Minsk, might trade away some other things in exchange for some symbolic concessions. Mm. So it's a very...
So you see this moving in Moscow's direction?
Picture.
So you see it moving in Moscow's direction right now?
I wouldn't want to make a prediction about it, but you know, I think it's very much in the balance. What must be said very firmly, and I think this is something the West is going to, the United States understands and will be reminded of again, is that the Ukrainians themselves will not accept mm-hmm. Moscow's blueprint for a settlement. My view, and it's the mainstream Ukrainian view, is that Russia will not surrender control of the eastern border of Ukraine until they gain control of the western border of Ukraine, by which I mean hard guarantees that Ukraine, by their definition, is going to be a neutral and federal state.
Mm-hmm. Which means a dysfunctional, Moscow client, essentially.
And backed with Western guarantees that this will be the case, Washington is wise enough to know, if they accepted this, they would lose Poroshenko and Yatsenyuk. There would be turbulence in the country, and everything we have tried to do will be lost because the Ukrainians will not accept it.
So we're at a stalemate then. This is heading for a frozen conflict then.
Well, I think our determination, our excessive interest in pursuing new approaches, even when there's nothing new, opening new forums of discussion, all of this, I think what it does is that it prolongs Moscow's illusion that we will give Ukraine away, and it greatly deepens anxiety inside Ukraine itself, and not only there, but in the Baltic states. So our lack of clarity is costing us support and political capital.
And is unlikely to lead to a settlement. Vladimir,
you know, sign of it.
Vladimir, you caused me to giggle when you wrote on your Facebook page, it was a few months back, that Moscow is always looking for the committee to run the world, basically meaning the Russians and the Americans solve every problem together. They kind of got it right now, no? I mean, the Americans are talking to them. They are talking. The Europeans have suddenly disengaged from the process. Moscow and Washington are talking to each other on various levels. They got what they wanted here or not?
I think they clearly wanted to institutionalize the Nuland-Surkov format. You could see that in questions by the Russian state media to the U.S. Ambassador John Taft yesterday. which Taft essentially declined and said that this was a one-off event. Uh-huh. We have no intention of repeating it. But again, Moscow, that would be Moscow's dream come true. To rule Ukraine behind Ukrainian back and to decide all the important questions of geopolitics with the United States. Mm-hmm. That's the entire point of both the Ukrainian operation and the Syrian operation, mm-hmm. is to get the U.S. Mm-hmm. to pay attention to what Moscow has to say, mm-hmm. and to take that into account. Yeah. I think with regard to Minsk too and to Donbas, there are two outcomes that Moscow views acceptable. One is strict implementation, word-by-word implementation of Minsk too, which basically means that Ukraine needs to accept the republics as autonomous entities with very significant powers and with de facto republics control over the Russian border, not Ukrainian control. There'll be obviously Ukrainian uniforms and Ukrainian flags, but the units would be
Russian.
Would be essentially Russian-led. And if that happens, that's fine with Moscow because it achieves the geopolitical objectives and lifts sanctions if the West says, well, the Minsk II is fulfilled. And if that proves to be impossible, and the last meeting at Minsk, you saw the members of the DNR essentially putting forward proposals for the constitutional amendments in Ukraine that are clearly unacceptable to Kiev, like, you know, the quota for in the Ukrainian parliament for the Donetsk and Lugansk republics, and the veto power over foreign policy and foreign trade decisions. So if that is unacceptable, and Poroshenko and Yatsenyuk essentially demur and allow Minsk to fail. But if the blame is apportioned for failure is apportioned strictly to Ukraine and not to Russia, then Russia makes the case that sanctions needs to be lifted because the failure of Minsk is Ukraine's fault. Mm. And if sanctions are lifted or perhaps weakened significantly, then it also accomplishes an important objective by keeping the conflict frozen.
Mm-hmm. So keeping a frozen conflict with sanctions weakened or lifted, the worst case scenario for Moscow, of course, is a frozen conflict with sanctions remaining in place.
Right.
That's the outcome there. Yeah. They're
of course, they want the sanctions lifted or significantly relieved, but again, they want their geopolitical objectives to be met as well.
Mm-hmm.
They know they can accept a lot of the Western vocabulary and a lot of the narrative as long as they control the detail on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
That is, you know, this is what they are very good at. This is one reason why from the beginning the OSCE has always said you cannot have a legitimate election under conditions of armed occupation. And the fact that it's no longer a de jure occupation, but just de facto, does not change it. Just to add one point to the objectives that Vladimir rightly cited, in the Russian view of federalism, the individual republics would also have a right to block national decisions that no constituent part of any federal state in the world has a right to do. So that means that an EU association agreement would, of course, have to have the consent of Donetsk and Luhansk. Again, a Western word is adopted, which is very respectable, to justify practices that no one would accept if they actually understood.
Right. But that's a non-starter, and it seems to me the only question now is, are we heading for a frozen conflict with sanctions in place, or are we heading for a frozen conflict with sanctions eased, right? I don't see any other realistic outcome on this.
I would bet some money on the second option.
Uh-huh.
Frozen conflict with sanctions eased.
All right. Well, then to wrap it up, James, which one do you see? Frozen conflict with sanctions eased or frozen conflict with sanctions in place?
I think, as I said it a moment ago, the problem is that unity has diminished in 2016, and therefore we cannot make a confident prediction.
Mm. All right, well, on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me from Oxford, England, has been veteran Kremlin watcher James Scher, an associate fellow with Chatham House's Russia and Eurasia program and author of the recently published report, The New East-West Discord, Russian Objectives and Western Interests. Also joining us from Moscow has been foreign affairs analyst Vladimir Frolov, president of the Left Group and a columnist at Sloan.ru. Thank you, gentlemen, for the enlightening discussion.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks for inviting.
Thanks.
And I'd also like to thank our patient, brilliant, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Buturin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, whom you can follow on Twitter at Pasha Buturin. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFRL.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.